January 31st, 1976, Bastrop County, Texas. 73-year-old John Whatley and his 68-year-old wife, Faye Whatley, failed to show up for the wedding of Faye's granddaughter, so the police are asked to perform a wellness check at their ranch. John and Faye are discovered to be missing, but there's a bullet hole in their bedroom window, and the bedroom door has been removed from the residence. Years later, serial killer Henry Lee Lucas confesses to having murdered the Whatleys and disposing of their bodies, but there is no evidence to corroborate his story, and the couple are never found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a truly bizarre missing persons case involving an elderly married couple, the 1976 disappearances of John and Faye Whatley. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Diane Daly, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Diane. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for over 3 years now, and if you'd like to enter, and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, I recently learned about this particular case when I came across the profile pages for the two victims at the missing persons website, The Charlie Project. Last month, I participated in a podcast-a-thon fundraiser to raise money for The Charlie Project's founder, Megan Good, and did a live stream in which I discussed some of the more interesting profile pages for obscure missing persons cases that I had found on the website. The disappearances of John and Faye Whatley was one of them, and after doing some additional research into the story, I decided it would be the perfect topic for an episode of The Trail Went Cold. In spite of their ages, John and Faye had only been married for a few years at the time they went missing, and John was a self-made millionaire who lived a rather reclusive lifestyle on a remote ranch. For this reason, there was initial speculation that the Whatleys' disappearance was a financially motivated kidnapping, but no ransom demand ever came in, and the only sign of violence inside their residence was a bullet hole in the bedroom window. The case would take an interesting turn when convicted serial killer Henry Lee Lucas confessed to being responsible for the Whatleys' murders, but as I'm sure you're well aware, Lucas was notorious for falsely confessing to hundreds of murders. Opinions were divided about whether or not Lucas's confession was genuine, but there have been no major developments in the investigation in 4 decades, and the circumstances of how the Whatleys went missing are so odd that we're going to attempt to figure out what happened to them on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearances of John and Faye Whatley. Our story begins in Bastrop County in 1976, and our central figures are 73-year-old John Whatley and his 68-year-old wife, Faye Whatley, who have been married for nearly 4 years. John was originally born in Chihuahua, Mexico, to a physician father, but after his family's property was confiscated by revolutionaries when he was young, John was forced to escape to the United States and managed to smuggle himself across the border into Texas by hiding underneath a wagon. During the 1920s, John began operating a small dairy on land, which would eventually become part of the capital city of Austin. He would also invest in some land which he subsequently sold for $500,000 in cash, which helped him become a self-made millionaire. Sometime during the 1950s, John made the move to Bastrop County, and he would build himself a three-bedroom home on a nearly 1,500-acre ranch in the unincorporated community of Hills Prairie, located about 6 miles south of the town of Bastrop. Before he got married to Faye, John went through four other marriages and had one son named Barney, who was currently 41 years old. Faye was also previously married and had a son and daughter, though her son was tragically killed in a plane crash. By this point, John's net worth is believed to be somewhere between $2 and $7 million, but even though he and Faye own matching Mercedes-Benz automobiles, they are not known for flaunting their wealth. While Faye is known for being an outgoing person with a number of friends, John is described as being a loner who mostly keeps to himself. On January the 30th, John and Faye were scheduled to travel to Houston in order to attend the wedding rehearsal for Faye's granddaughter. However, the Whatleys failed to show up for the rehearsal or the wedding the following day. They did not contact anyone, or even use the reservations they had made at a Houston motel, and when all phone calls to their residence went unanswered, Faye's son-in-law became concerned enough to contact the Bastrop County Sheriff's Office and ask them to perform a wellness check. At around 10:30 p.m. on the evening of January the 31st, a sheriff's deputy traveled to the Whatley Ranch, and while John and Faye's matching Mercedes, as well as their pickup truck, were still parked inside the garage, there was no sign of the couple anywhere. A herd of cattle were in a nearby field, and the couple also owned five dogs who were still outside the house, but it appeared they had not been fed in days. When the deputy went to the front door, he discovered that it was locked, but this was apparently very unusual for the Whatleys, as they often did not bother to lock their residence when they went out, even while leaving on vacation. When Bastrop County Sheriff Jimmy Nutt was summoned to the scene, he would enter the house through an open window located near the back, where he discovered that the residence was empty, and all of John and Faye's personal items had been left behind, including their wallets and eyeglasses. Since no valuables appeared to be stolen, and there was still money inside the wallets, it did not appear that a robbery had taken place. However, while there was no noticeable sign of struggle or foul play, the master bedroom was a very unusual scene, as a bullet hole was discovered in one of the window panes. While no slug could be found, the hole seemed to be the size of a .22 caliber bullet, and it appeared to have been fired through the window from inside the bedroom at waist-length height. Since broken glass was still on the floor and on the ground outside the window, the shot had definitely been fired recently. The shade had also been pulled all the way down, even though it was supposedly uncharacteristic for the Whatleys to do this, and while the shade had its own bullet hole in it, it did not seem to match the trajectory of the hole in the window. A second bullet mark seemed to be present on the concrete tile interior of the window, so after the first shot was fired through the window pane, someone may have pulled down the shade and fired a second shot through it. According to people who knew him, John owned two .22 caliber revolvers, but while one of them was found fully loaded in a dresser drawer, the other revolver was missing. Bullet fragments were also discovered in a corner of the bedroom, but the floor appeared to have been recently cleaned. However, it was not until one of the Whatleys' ranch workers visited the residence that police noticed the most bizarre detail about the scene. The entire bedroom door was missing. It was described as being hollow and mahogany-stained, with a green-painted doorknob, but someone had seemingly pulled the pins from the hinges and removed the entire door. John had previously installed a latch on the door to prevent it from slamming whenever the windows were opened, but the latch appeared to be damaged, and a wood splinter from the door was found on the floor. The ranch worker told police that he had been inside the residence on many previous occasions and confirmed that the door was always there before the Whatleys went missing. One theory which was pushed forward was that the door could have been used as a stretcher to carry one or both members of the couple out of the house if they were killed or injured. In fact, unexplained scratch marks were found on the residence's front door, which could have been made if the bedroom door was carried through there. Law enforcement would perform an extensive search of the property and the surrounding area, but they could find no trace of John or Faye. The ranch was located in close proximity to the Colorado River, but a search of the water did not turn up anything either. The Whatley's nearest neighbor, who lived about 500 yards away from the ranch, did not recall seeing or hearing anything unusual, so an attempt was made to backtrack the couple's movements before they disappeared. The last confirmed sighting of Faye took place on January the 26th, as a friend of hers who owned a shop in Bastrop claimed that Faye stopped by to have lunch that day and appeared to be in good spirits. It sounds like the last witness who could confirm interacting with John was a contractor who was picking pecans on the ranch and said that he got into an argument with John, who appeared to be drunk, on the evening of January 27th. The following morning, a ranch worker showed up at the residence, but said that no one answered the door. A copy of the January 27th edition of the Austin American Statesman newspaper was found inside the house, but the January 28th edition was still inside the Watleys' mailbox, so this seemed to indicate that the couple vanished sometime on the 27th or during the early morning hours of the 28th. Some wolf hunters claimed that at around 9:45 p.m. on the evening of the 27th, they saw what they described as a blue or green Ford van or pickup truck with a camper heading down the road towards the Watley Ranch, and another witness would report seeing this vehicle driving back in the opposite direction between 30 minutes to 1 hour later. Since John was a millionaire, there was speculation that the Watleys were kidnapped and the disappearances were financially motivated, but no ransom demand was ever called in. A $10,000 reward was offered for information by Faye's daughter, and at one point, Sheriff Nutt became so frustrated by the lack of progress in the investigation that he appeared on television and sent out a plea to any kidnappers who may have been responsible for the couple's disappearance, stating, quote, "An immunity could be worked out if they are returned unharmed," end quote. At the time, John's son Barney lived in Austin with his wife and three children and worked a job as a weed inspector for the city's sanitation department, where he drew a salary of $1,000 per month. By his own admission, Barney did not see his father all that often and considered himself to be financially independent of him, but he stood to inherit half of John's estate. But interestingly enough, Barney just happened to drive a green 1970 Ford van, which seemed to match the description of the vehicle, seen driving towards the Watley Ranch on the evening of January 27th. When questioned by investigators, Barney denied any knowledge or involvement in what happened, but he declined to take a polygraph and retained the services of an attorney, citing what he described as a quote-unquote disagreement with law enforcement officials. Anyway, the investigation would reach a standstill, though there would be another strange development about 1 year later, when the Watleys' missing bedroom door was found inside a barn on the property. The barn had reportedly been searched at least a dozen times beforehand by the sheriff's office, the Texas Rangers, and the FBI, but the door was not there. However, the case would make the news again in April of 1984, after it was announced that notorious serial killer Henry Lee Lucas had confessed to being responsible for the Watleys' disappearance. Now, I'm sure many of you are already familiar with Henry Lee Lucas, and I'm going to be talking more about him later on in this episode, but here's a brief rundown about his background. We know that Lucas' first confirmed murder took place when he killed his own mother in 1960, and he would spend over a decade in prison for the crime before he was released. But in 1983, Lucas would attain major notoriety when he was arrested in Texas on a seemingly routine weapons charge, but suddenly confessed to murdering two victims, 82-year-old Kate Rich and 15-year-old Frieda Becky Powell, who happened to be the niece of Lucas's longtime partner in crime, Otis Toole. After this, Lucas spent the next several years confessing to literally hundreds of murders, and he would be convicted of 10 of them, earning him a total of one death sentence, six life sentences, and an additional 210 years in prison. Now, of course, it's no big secret that the vast majority of Lucas's confessions were completely false, and if you would like more details about this story, I would highly recommend checking out the Netflix documentary series, The Confession Killer. But long story short, once word got out that Lucas was willing to confess to anything, a number of police departments were more than happy to pin a number of their unsolved crimes on him, even if there was no other corroborating evidence to prove he did it. Well, given that Lucas was incarcerated in Texas, it probably shouldn't come as much of a surprise to learn that he confessed to murdering John and Faye Watley. He told investigators that he and an accomplice had stabbed the Watleys to death before taking their bodies to Nevada and dumping them in the desert. Lucas even went so far as to accompany the Bastrop County Sheriff's Office to the Watleys' ranch in order to describe how he committed the crime. While it's easy to assume that Lucas named Otis Toole as his accomplice, this has never been publicly confirmed. At the time, investigators seemed to find Lucas's confession to be so credible that they were considering filing murder charges against him, but this never came to fruition. In January of 1985, Tommy Mosley, the outgoing sheriff of Bastrop County, stated that he considered the Watley case to be solved because he believed that Lucas provided details about the crime which only the killer could have known. But the incoming sheriff, I.R. Nig Hoskins, was not fully convinced, and he told the press that he had new information which compelled him to reopen the case. Regardless, it's unclear if Lucas is still considered to be a serious suspect, but he died in prison of heart failure in March of 2001. As for John and Faye Watley, there don't appear to have been any major developments in their case since the mid-1980s, so the actual truth about their disappearances remains a mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this is one of those frustrating cold cases which has a number of intriguing details, but since there is a limited amount of information available, and the last real media coverage took place over 35 years ago, there are a ton of unanswered questions. Like I just mentioned, there were some people in power who believed that Henry Lee Lucas's confession to the crime when it originally happened, but we now know how unreliable Lucas's confessions were, which is why they devoted an entire Netflix documentary series to the subject. Even if by chance he was telling the truth, John and Faye Watley's bodies have never been found, so this is definitely still an unsolved mystery. Before I talk more about this case, I should mention an interesting side story where John Watley came dangerously close to being a murder victim 2 decades before he went missing. In July of 1955, 78-year-old Felix Heidel lived on a 100-acre ranch located in Travis County near the town of Leander, but he wound up being strangled to death with a wire noose. The perpetrators were a pair of brothers named Calvin and Charlie White, who subsequently transported Heidel's body 40 miles to Bastrop County and buried him in a shallow grave located across the Colorado River from John Watley's ranch. The motive for the crime was that the White brothers wanted to rustle Heidel's herd of cattle, but following their arrest, it would come out that they had considered the possibility of murdering John instead, because he owned more cattle. While the White brothers were both long dead by the time the Watleys went missing 2 decades later, investigators still looked into possible connections between the two crimes, though it sounds like they found nothing. Anyway, at the time the Watleys went missing, the Bastrop County Sheriff was Jimmy Nutt, who was very close to retirement at that point, but this case consumed him so much that he almost considered postponing his retirement until it was solved. However, after he did retire, Nutt agreed to be interviewed for an article published in the Austin American Statesman in June of 1979, and for the first time ever, he publicly revealed his personal belief that John murdered Faye and disposed of her body before taking off to Mexico. Even though Faye was described as being outgoing, John sounded like a pretty eccentric individual who was not known for being a people person. While there aren't many details available about John's previous marriages before he met Faye, the fact that he went through 5 marriages in total might be an indicator that he was not the easiest person to live with. While following the couple's disappearance, a search of the property turned up a box of legal documents inside a dry well, which did not paint a healthy picture of the Watleys' marriage. In 1972, only 14 weeks after they originally got married, John filed divorce papers against Faye, but she responded by filing a countersuit. The original papers for Faye's countersuit were also inside the box and contained numerous allegations that she had been mistreated by her husband, but the word lies had been handwritten on the papers next to each allegation, presumably by John. But when the couple went to court for their divorce hearing and received a postponement, They went out for coffee together afterward, and then suddenly decided that they didn't want to get divorced anymore. John even responded by buying Faye her own Mercedes the very next day, though the marriage would still be described as a rocky one over the next few years. As we go along, I will review some of the pieces of evidence which made Sheriff Nutt suspect that John murdered Faye, but you might recall how eyewitnesses reported seeing a vehicle described as either a van or pickup truck with a camper driving down the road towards the Whatley Ranch on the evening of January the 27th before it was seen heading in the opposite direction 30 minutes to 1 hour later. Nutt theorized that whoever drove that vehicle helped John remove Faye's body from the house to dispose of it, and given that all of the Whatleys' vehicles were left behind in their garage, perhaps the driver gave John a ride to the border so he can make his escape. Remember, John was originally born in Mexico and spoke fluent Spanish, so he wouldn't have had much trouble disappearing and blending in, and at 73 years old, it's not like he would have needed to hide out all that long before he passed away of natural causes. All that being said, the age issue is one of the biggest problems with this theory, as why would a wealthy man living a comfortable lifestyle decide to throw it all away at age 73 by murdering his wife? He left virtually everything behind, including millions of dollars, and it's not clear if he would have had any money on him to survive on the run. If this was a crime of passion, where John lost control and killed his wife in an unplanned fit of rage, that would be one thing, but the fact that another person had to be involved to help get rid of Faye's body and provide John with transportation would seem to point to premeditation. But I will acknowledge that some of the weirder details about the scene at the house could be explained if John was the perpetrator. There was no noticeable forced entry, and the front door was locked, and it seems odd that home invaders would lock the door behind them when they left. There was also no sign of any robbery, struggle, or foul play, though the bedroom floor appeared to have been recently cleaned. We also have bullet holes in the bedroom window and the shade, which were caused by one, possibly two shots from a .22 caliber weapon, but the slugs themselves could not be found and may have been removed from the scene. While a fully loaded .22 caliber gun was found inside a drawer, John supposedly owned two of them, and the second one could not be accounted for. But of course, an alternate explanation is that John could have grabbed his gun and fired a shot at an intruder in self-defense before the weapon was taken away from him. The box which was discovered in the well, containing legal documents pertaining to the Whatleys' previous attempt at a divorce, is very odd, but for all we know, John could have placed them there years earlier, and they have no relevance to this case. You can interpret the evidence in so many different ways. The bullet hole in the window could have been the result of an intruder firing a warning shot in order to frighten the Whatleys into leaving the house with them. Or perhaps a bullet was fired into John or Faye and traveled right through their body into the window, and the shooter was able to clean up all blood and forensic evidence which showed that a murder had taken place. Whatever happened, the person who fired that shot seemed to do an effective job at covering their tracks. The lack of forced entry could also have been because the Whatleys willingly let someone inside the house before the shot was fired, and they were harmed by someone they knew and trusted. Any way you slice it, the most bizarre detail of this entire case is undoubtedly the disappearance and reappearance of the bedroom door. I honestly cannot think of another case where something like that has happened, and Sheriff Nutt made a very memorable quote about the situation. Quote, "The biggest mystery of the whole thing is the door. If you can solve the door, you can solve the case, and you're a better man than I am." End quote. The primary theory seems to be that the door was removed from its hinges so that it could be used as a makeshift stretcher to transport either John, Faye, or both of their bodies out of the house. While this could mean that someone was killed there, it's also possible this was done because someone was injured and could not walk on their own accord. For instance, if it was an attempted ransom kidnapping and the perpetrator needed John and Faye alive, this would have been a convenient way to transport them outside. Of course, since it's physically impossible for one person to carry a stretcher, this points to multiple people being involved, and if John killed Faye, he would have had to enlist someone's help to move her. This is another detail which might point to John being the perpetrator, since removing a door from its hinges is a time-consuming process which seems very risky for an intruder. As a 73-year-old, it may have been difficult for John to transport a body on his own, though since he was constantly doing manual labor on his ranch, John was described as being in excellent physical shape, so it's not like we're talking about a frail senior citizen. But for the life of me, I cannot figure out why the missing door suddenly turned up in the Watleys' barn 1 year later. I'm not sure how they were able to conclusively determine that it was the same door, but the bedroom door was described as being mahogany-stained with a green-painted doorknob, so perhaps it was very distinct. A wooden splinter had also been found on the bedroom floor, and I guess it's possible that they matched it to the door. It's never been specified if any forensic evidence, such as blood or fingerprints, was found on the door, but I can only assume not. It sounds like this barn had been searched nearly a dozen times by different law enforcement agencies, and while Sheriff Nutt did acknowledge that they could have missed it, a door seems like a much too large and distinctive item to overlook, though it's never been clarified if it was well hidden or lying around in plain sight. No matter who was responsible, I have no idea why they would hold onto this door for an entire year before returning it to the scene of the crime. Theoretically, if John was the perpetrator, I could see him disposing of the door in his barn after using it to transport his wife's body into a vehicle. But I don't see him taking an entire door across the border into Mexico with him and returning to the US to get rid of it 1 year later. Assuming that law enforcement simply didn't just miss it, I guess the most logical explanation is that the perpetrator may have forgotten they had the door in their possession that entire time, but why take the risk of going back to the Watley Ranch rather than disposing of it elsewhere? And here's yet another bizarre side story I haven't even mentioned yet. In May of 1976, nearly 4 months after the Watleys went missing, a man contacted the Bastrop County Sheriff's Office to inform them he had been fishing in Lake Bastrop and caught a 5-pound catfish, which had what appeared to be the bones of a human finger inside. This man then placed the bones inside a cup in the back of his pickup truck, but while driving to the sheriff's office to turn them over to the police, his dog ate them. Lake Bastrop is located a few miles away from the Watley Ranch, and would have been an ideal place to dispose of a body, but without forensic testing on those finger bones, we have no idea if they had any significance to this case. So before we start looking at other potential suspects, we have to get Henry Lee Lucas's so-called confession out of the way. You might recall that back in October of 2018, I released an episode about the murder of an unidentified Jane Doe who had been nicknamed Orange Socks, because that was the only garment of clothing on her body. The victim had been found in Williamson County, Texas on October the 31st, 1979, but less than a year after my episode was released, DNA testing finally identified her as 23-year-old Deborah Jackson. Back in the 1980s, Lucas had confessed to murdering Deborah after he picked her up hitchhiking, but even though he was convicted of the crime and received the death penalty, it now seems very unlikely that he was the real killer. Lucas had a timesheet from his job and a cash paycheck to show that he was actually over 1,000 miles away in Florida on the date Deborah was murdered, but because he had made a confession and had already garnered a reputation for being a notorious serial killer by the time he went on trial, it seems like the jury completely disregarded the exculpatory evidence and found him guilty. Now, even though Lucas was undeniably a murderer who belonged in prison, there were a lot of moral issues with the fact that the only crime he received the death penalty for was a murder he could not have committed. Due to the controversy, then-Texas Governor George W. Bush decided to halt Lucas's execution in 1998 by commuting his sentence to life imprisonment. The fact of the matter is that when Lucas knew he was never going to be a free man again, he had no qualms about making false confessions to unsolved murders for such privileges as better food and living conditions in prison. In fact, Lucas admitted that he sometimes made these confessions for his own personal amusement because he wanted to make the police look stupid, and more often than not, he would later recant them. But if a law enforcement agency had an unsolved murder they wanted to get off their books, they would be willing to feed Lucas details about the crime in order to strengthen his confession. If you've watched the Confession Killer series on Netflix, they focus a good chunk of their last episode on the murders in which an alternate suspect was charged many years after Lucas falsely confessed, meaning that his interference allowed the real killers to get away with it for a lot longer than they should have. The person who actually murdered Deborah Jackson has still not been identified to this day, and it's possible that Lucas also tainted the investigation into the disappearance of the Whatleys. According to Bastrop County Sheriff Tommy Mosley, who had been working the case at that time, he believed Lucas's confession was genuine because he provided details about the crime that only the perpetrator could have known. But after what I've learned about many of his other cases, I wonder if this translates to provided details about the crime that were fed to him. Well, here's one red flag which makes me highly skeptical. Lucas made the confession only a few days after he was sentenced to death for the murder of Deborah Jackson. So by that point, Lucas probably figured that he had absolutely nothing left to lose and may have felt compelled to confess to some other unsolved murders just for the fun of it. He actually agreed to accompany the authorities to the Whatley Ranch in order to show them how he committed the crime, but by this point, Lucas knew he was going to be spending the rest of his life on death row, so I'm sure he would have considered this field trip a nice respite from being confined to his cell. Another detail about Lucas's confession I find odd is that he claimed that he disposed of John and Faye in the Nevada desert, but it would have required him to leave Texas and travel through two other states in order to get there. So why take the risk of driving that far with two bodies inside your vehicle? Lucas also claimed that he committed these murders with an accomplice, but investigators never confirmed if this was his longtime partner in crime, Otis Toole. Okay, if you visit the website henryleelucasconfessions.com, you'll find a photograph of a letter sent to the Texas Rangers by John's sister, Anita Whatley Lorenz, on June 22, 1984. It reads, quote, "I received a clipping taken from the Dallas News of June the 7th. The clipping stated that a man by the name of Toole had confessed that he was paid $10,000 to kill my brother, John Whatley, and his wife, Faye. He met a man by the name of Lucas in San Antonio, gave him $5,000, and they went to the ranch not far from Bastrop, Texas, and stabbed the couple to death. In a previous article, Lucas said that he did the killing and that he had an associate, but did not name him. He also said that the bodies were taken to the desert in Nevada and dumped. I hope that you are continuing to work on this case to find the person who hired these men. He is as guilty as they are and is a social menace and should be removed from circulation. I hope to hear from you." End quote. Well, try as I might, I could not find this aforementioned news article about Otis Toole confessing his involvement in the Whatleys' disappearance, but Toole was just as notorious for making false confessions and recanting them as Lucas. But the cover story seems to be that Lucas and Toole were paid $10,000 to kill the Whatleys as part of a murder-for-hire plot, though no information appears to have been provided about who actually hired them. However, there may be a big issue with the timeline here. It's been reported that Lucas and Toole first met each other at a soup kitchen in Jacksonville, Florida in 1976, and while I'm not sure of the exact date, it sounds like it was later in the year after the Whatleys went missing. I know that Lucas got married to a woman named Betty Crawford in Maryland in December of 1975, and was living in the town of Port Deposit in January of 1976, which is where he resided until the following year. It's true that during this time period, Lucas would often leave and disappear for days at a time without telling his wife where he was, but when you look at the timeline, what are the odds that Lucas would have been able to travel nearly 800 miles from Port Deposit to Jacksonville to meet Toole for the first time, before they subsequently traveled over 1,000 miles west to Bastrop County to murder the Whatleys on January the 27th? And even if Toole wasn't Lucas's accomplice to the crime, where did Lucas meet this person, and when did he get the time to make the lengthy trip from Maryland to Texas? And that doesn't even account for his alleged detour to Nevada to dump the bodies, which is in the opposite direction of his residence in Maryland. The reason so many of Lucas's confessions fell apart is because when you looked at the dates and locations of all these murders he was supposed to have committed, it would have been physically impossible for him to travel to all these destinations during the allotted window of time. Well, I guess it's not impossible that Lucas could have been in Texas at the time John and Faye went missing, I find it extremely unlikely, and I believe this is yet another investigation which was seriously hampered by his false confessions. But of course, that only opens up the question, what really did happen to the Whatleys? Well, the obvious direction would be to look at who benefited when John and Faye went missing. They both had one surviving child each, and while I'd like to share the first name of Faye's daughter, all the newspaper articles about this case simply refer to her as Mrs. Bennett Blake. It says that she was Faye's sole heir, but it's unclear how much she was entitled to receive, since John was the one who technically built up the couple's fortune, which was worth between $2 and $7 million. However, Faye's daughter lived 140 miles away in Houston, and I have to assume her whereabouts were accounted for during the time period the Whatleys went missing. Besides, I don't find it very likely that she would arrange for the murders of her mother and stepfather around the same time her own daughter was getting married. In fact, if John and Faye hadn't been scheduled to attend the wedding, it might have taken a lot longer for anyone to even realize they were missing. John's son Barney would definitely seem like a more promising suspect, as he lived in Austin, much closer to the ranch, and in spite of having a wealthy father, he was financially independent and worked a job that earned him around $12,000 per year, which is about the equivalent of $55,000 in today's money. It sounds like Barney had previously worked on his father's ranch, but left after a disagreement between them, though no specific details are available about when or why this happened. While it doesn't sound like they had a particularly close relationship, John did make Barney the heir to half of his estate, and even though this is only an assumption, I'm guessing he made Faye the heir to his other half. Now, one of the main reasons Barney came under suspicion is because he drove a green 1970 Ford van, which does kind of match the description of the vehicle seen driving towards the Whatley Ranch on the evening of January the 27th. But it's worth noting that the eyewitnesses described the vehicle as being a Ford van or pickup truck with a camper, which was colored green or blue, so this seems to indicate that they did not get a clear look, and it may not have been an exact match to Barney's van. During the early stages of the investigation, Barney declined to take a polygraph and hired an attorney due to what he described as a quote-unquote disagreement with law enforcement. But during a newspaper interview he gave 3 years later, Barney said that Sheriff Nutt eventually told him that he no longer believed he was responsible for what happened to John and Faye, stating, quote, "The sheriff really surprised me. He was the only one who really cared what happened to them," end quote. While inheriting his father's multi-million-dollar estate would definitely give Barney a motive to kill John and Faye. Theoretically, if Barney showed up at the ranch one night, the couple probably would have let him inside the house, which would explain the lack of forced entry. But the big issue with the theory of Barney murdering his father for the inheritance is that John's body was never found, and since a person generally has to be missing for at least 7 years before they are declared legally deceased, this meant that Barney would have had to wait a while before getting his hands on the money. Of course, like I mentioned earlier, Sheriff Nutt's own personal theory was that it was John who killed Faye before fleeing the area, but if that's the case, there's no way he could have disposed of Faye's body on his own. If the vehicle seen driving towards the Whatley Ranch was Barney's van, could this mean that John enlisted the help of his son? Well, given that they were not particularly close, I'm not sure what motive Barney would have had to help John cover up a crime and flee the country, because after all, it's not like he can immediately inherit everything without his father's body. For his part, Barney always personally leaned towards the theory that John and Faye were both killed by an outside third party, as he didn't think his father could stay away for that long without contacting anyone. The problem is that if you discount the idea of John or Barney being responsible for what happened, who else could have done this? While I don't have any information about John's previous four marriages before he met Faye, I've always considered the possibility that perhaps one of his exes could have had such a hatred towards him as to commit murder. Even though no ransom demands were ever sent, an alternate possibility is that this could have been a botched ransom kidnapping, where the perpetrators made an attempt to abduct Faye from the residence in order to force her husband to pay for her return. But I previously mentioned that John was in excellent physical shape for someone his age, and may have put up more of a fight than the kidnappers were expecting. As a result, something went horribly wrong, which led to John, Faye, or both of them being killed, so the responsible parties had to use the bedroom door to stretcher out their bodies, and they subsequently disposed of them at another location. Whatever happened, I think it's very likely that it was connected to the vehicle seen heading towards the Whatley Ranch, and whoever driving it knows the full truth. Given how baffling this whole case is, I guess I shouldn't be surprised that investigators were willing to give credence to the confession from Henry Lee Lucas, because it's not like any of the other theories make much sense either. I'm not sure if we'll ever know the truth, but this is why I'm glad that websites like the Charlie Project exist, because they keep unsolved cold cases like this alive, and ensure that people like John and Faye Whatley are never forgotten. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearances of the Whatleys, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Diane Daly for narrating the opening of our episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I did something a little different from the norm by releasing an episode about a case which has been solved, the murder-suicide of the Benoit family. You probably know that I'm a lifelong professional wrestling fan, and Chris Benoit's decision to murder his wife Nancy and 7-year-old son Daniel before taking his own life has always haunted me, so I decided to put together an episode in which I detailed this horrible crime and shared my personal thoughts on it. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Lindsay CG, Matt K, Stanislav V, Miriam E, Christine BD, Laura T, CN, and Gus Schultz. Thank you all so much for your support. I'd also like to mention that this coming Saturday, March the 27th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I will be hosting another Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathon, in which I'll be screening classic segments from Unsolved Mysteries, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. I will be providing the link to the screening room for this event in this episode's show notes, and you can also find the links pinned to the top of our podcast's Facebook and Twitter pages. So once again, join us for our Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch this coming Saturday, March the 27th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Hope to see you there. I'd also like to mention that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London. I'd previously stated that CrimeCon UK was set to take place on the weekend of June 12th and the 13th, but due to certain restrictions, they have now elected to postpone it until the weekend of September the 25th and 26th, so fingers crossed that it will still happen as planned. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. So to receive 10% off, either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.